shifting to a cluster of stories that all orbit around the same fundamental concern. Who controls the infrastructure you depend on? Starting with OpenWRT 1, which scored 672 points, the second highest score of the day. This is a router that runs the OpenWRT open source firmware, but the hardware itself is a certified open hardware design. The significance here is subtle but real. Open firmware running on proprietary hardware still has attack surfaces at the chip level that you can't audit. A router where both the firmware and the hardware design are open source and auditable is a genuinely different security posture.
For a business audience, the context here is the continuing cascade of revelations about compromised network equipment. The Volt Typhoon disclosures in 2024, the Salt Typhoon telecom intrusions in late 2024 and 2025, these were large-scale operations where threat actors had established persistent access inside American telecommunications infrastructure by compromising routers and network edge devices. The attack surface for those intrusions was often proprietary firmware that network operators couldn't audit, running on hardware with undocumented management interfaces. OpenWRT 1 is a direct response to that threat model.
The HN comments included several network security practitioners who were enthusiastic but realistic. One recurring point was that open hardware is necessary but not sufficient. You also need a supply chain you can trust for the physical components, and that's a much harder problem. The trusted platform module story, the Bloomberg Big Hack reporting on hardware implants, legitimate or not, has made the security community appropriately paranoid about the gap between a hardware design being open and the manufactured device being trustworthy.
Connecting to the Microsoft tracking story, PCMag published a piece based on reporting around a hacker's arrest that revealed Microsoft can correlate user activity across devices and accounts using a Windows device ID that persists even through some privacy protective measures. The 100-point score and 39 comments might suggest this is a smaller story, but I think it's been somewhat underappreciated. The specific detail is that in the course of prosecuting this particular hacker, court documents revealed Microsoft provided law enforcement with tracking data linked to a Windows device ID that the user had believed was severed by account changes.
What makes this technically interesting, and the HN comments got into this, is the persistence mechanism. The claim is that the device ID survives certain resets and account deletions, and that Microsoft retains telemetry linked to that ID on their servers even after the user has taken steps they believed would break the tracking chain. This isn't new behavior. Windows telemetry has been a known privacy concern since Windows 10. But the specificity of how it was used in a criminal prosecution makes it concrete in a way that abstract telemetry discussions don't.
From a policy standpoint, this is going to intersect with the EU's Digital Markets Act enforcement timeline. Microsoft is already under scrutiny in Europe for how Windows bundles services and how telemetry data is handled. Evidence from criminal proceedings that Microsoft maintains persistent user identifiers in ways that aren't clearly disclosed to users is exactly the kind of specific documented behavior that regulators in Brussels find actionable.
Now, the JanisCape vulnerability, which is technically the most alarming story in today's lineup, even though it didn't score as highly. CVE 2026 to FI3359, a guest to host escape in KVM on x86. To explain why this matters for listeners unfamiliar with virtualization, KVM is the kernel-based virtual machine, the hypervisor that underlies the vast majority of cloud computing infrastructure. Amazon EC2, Google Compute Engine, a substantial portion of Azure, all running on KVM or derivatives. A guest-to-host escape means that code running inside a virtual machine can break out of that VM and execute on the host system.
In cloud security terms, this is about as bad as vulnerabilities get. The entire security model of multi-tenant cloud computing rests on the assumption that your VM is isolated from the VMs of other customers on the same physical host. A guest-to-host escape breaks that isolation. In theory, an attacker with access to a cloud VM, which they could simply rent, could escape their VM and access data or processes belonging to other customers on the same physical server.
The researchers who published JanisCape, it's a proof-of-concept exploit on GitHub, say they followed responsible disclosure procedures and the major cloud providers were notified before public release. The HN comments included several people who appeared to be cloud infrastructure engineers confirming that patches were being deployed. But the gap between patches available and all vulnerable hosts patched in a large cloud environment can be weeks, and that window matters.
Let's include a brief educational aside here, because the NSA and IETF story we're about to cover actually has some antitrust adjacent dynamics, and it's worth grounding listeners in how regulatory frameworks work in the standards world. Sarah, I'll let you take the NSA-IETF piece, but let me set up a quick background on how these power structures play out legally. When we talk about standards bodies like IETF or IEEE, they occupy a fascinating middle ground in competition law. The Sherman Act, passed in 1890, still the foundation of U.S. antitrust law, prohibits combinations in restraint of trade and monopolization. Critically, monopoly status under Sherman isn't just about market share. A company can have 80% market share and not be in violation if it got there through legitimate competition, better products, lower prices. The legal test is whether the monopoly was achieved or maintained through exclusionary conduct. In the standards world, this translates to what's called FRAND commitments, fair, reasonable, and non-discriminatory licensing. When a company participates in a standards process and their patented technology gets incorporated into the standard, they're obligated to license it on FRAND terms. If they try to leverage that standards position to extract super competitive royalties or exclude competitors, that's where antitrust exposure begins. The NSA's relationship with IETF has echoes of this. A powerful actor participating in a standards process with interests that may not align with the open, participatory norms that make the process legitimate.
And that context is exactly right for the DJB. That's Daniel J. Bernstein, blog post on NSA and IETF fairness. Bernstein has been one of the most persistent critics of NSA involvement in cryptographic standards since the dual EC-DRBG backdoor was confirmed in the Snowden documents. His new post is arguing that IETF's procedural norms around fairness are being gamed by well-resourced actors, specifically pointing toward NSA-affiliated participation, to slow down or weaken cryptographic standards that would reduce surveillance capability.
The 93HN comments were a genuine debate between people who think Bernstein's concerns are well-founded and documented, and people who think he's become too conspiratorial in his later career. The specific technical claims around recent IETF working group votes are hard to evaluate without deep familiarity with the relevant drafts. But the broader pattern he's documenting, that standards processes are vulnerable to capture by actors with resources and agenda, is not controversial. It's been documented in academic literature on standards economics for decades.
COMAPS also fits this segment thematically, even though it's more of a consumer product. It's a fork of the Organic Maps project, itself a fork of Maps.me, providing fully offline open source maps with no tracking, no telemetry, no Google. 607 points and 133 comments reflects genuine enthusiasm. The HN thread had extensive comparison with Osmand and other offline map options. What's notable about COMAP specifically is the governance model. They're structured to prevent the kind of VC-influenced pivot that took Maps.me from a beloved offline app to a commercial product that the community felt had betrayed its original ethos.